To dwell on a heath without studying its meanings was like wedding a foreigner without learning his tongue. The subtle beauties of the heath were lost to Eustacia. She only caught its vapors. An environment which would have made a contented woman a poet, a suffering woman a devotee, a pious woman a psalmist, even a giddy woman thoughtful, made a rebellious woman saturnine.
Good evening and welcome to A Novel Idea. This is your host, Rosemary Manchester. Every month we bring you books, current books, and classics, and discuss them with interesting people. Tonight my guest is a familiar voice in a role that may be a surprise to you. We all know Michelle Anna Jordan for her expertise with food and wine, and we listen to her show on Sunday evening, Mouthful. Tonight she's here in a different role to talk about another subject she knows a lot about, the novels of Thomas Hardy. We'll focus on The Return of the Native, and Michelle will also talk about other work by Hardy. Welcome, Michelle.
It's great to be here, Rosemary. Thank you.
Well, Thomas Hardy, what led you to the work of Thomas Hardy?
Well, in graduate school at Sonoma State, it wasn't long before I really found that I was most comfortable in the late 19th century. The Bronte sisters, for example, and one of the classes offered simply was the novels of Thomas Hardy. And the first one we read was The Return of the Native. And it captured me and, you know, was my nemesis at the same time because I got too involved with it. But I came to believe anyway that it's a really a pivotal work in the arc of Hardy's career as a novelist. And we should say that he did go on to have a career as a poet for, I think, nearly 25 years after he wrote his last novel. And I'm just fascinated by the transition of the Victorian period into the modern period. And in my opinion, that all turned on Hardy's work.
He is the pivotal writer then from the Victorians to the modern era. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that when I read it, years ago, that it never occurred to me that he was not a Victorian because he overlaps those Victorian years.
Well, The Return of the Native is still right in the middle of the Victorian period. But when you get up to his final novel, Jude the Obscure, where you're approaching the 20th century, I think, if I remember correctly, it came out in 1895. And increasingly, we see Hardy grappling with the sort of encroaching modern issues that the Victorian novel was really never built to address. But we see him struggling to do that. And I think you really see the beginnings of that struggle in Return of the Native. If he'd stopped with this one, I think he would still be considered a Victorian novelist. But when you read, especially the three that I think are his most important and most engaging, Return of the Native, Tess of the D'Urbervilles, and Jude the Obscure, you can't, I don't think, mistake the fact that it really didn't work in a certain sense. He really broke the form of the Victorian novel. And for the modern era of Virginia Woolf, D.H. Lawrence in particular, the Victorian form had to break because it couldn't contain the issues that people had to contend with at that time.
I understand. Now I have my homework. I don't think I've ever read Jude the Obscure.
Let me warn you, and let me warn our listeners as well. The woman who I wanted to be the chairman of my committee for my master's thesis told me, "I will be the chair of your committee as long as you don't deal with Jude the Obscure, because I will not read it again." And it ended up the natural progression of my work was that I had to write my master's thesis on Jude the Obscure. And it is a wrenching novel.
So readers, be warned.
Be warned.
Well, and we will have time to talk a bit about Tess and Jude the Obscure. But let's go to Return of the Native. The setting of The Return of the Native is just almost overwhelming. It's a very, very important part. The early descriptions of Egdon Heath in Wessex. Wessex is a fictional name, I believe, for Dorsetshire.
Yes, it's Hardy's Wessex, and he invented this whole county, which to me, has always reminded me of Sonoma County, like it might have been, say, 150 years ago. I think that's part of the reason I feel such affinity to Hardy's work. But yes, it was fictional, Wessex. And the heath is just a barren place where not much grows except low shrub and grasses and that sort of thing. It's not a particularly welcoming place, particularly when transportation is as it was then in England. You got places on foot, on horse cart, that sort of thing. So if you were on the heath, and we also see, to bring another novel into this, we also see the heath playing a similar role in that really great novel, Wuthering Heights. It's as important to the Brontes as it is to Hardy. And I think in both, it's really a character. And I think it's maybe even more of a character in Hardy than in the Brontes. But he addresses it. He continues throughout the entire book. The heath reflects what's going on in the lives of the people who live there. And you couldn't have Return of the Native without the heath.
And before that time, I don't think people had featured so much the setting of the story. They'd focused more on the story and the characters.
Yes, and there were novels of manners, you know, to a large degree, and they always ended well.
Yes.
With a moral lesson.
Well, it was fascinating to read in the book about all the walking. Everyone walked everywhere, and they knew the paths so well that they could do it in the dark.
Yes, it's really quite remarkable. We can barely, you know, walk from our driveways, you know, into our houses without having, you know, the porch light on, because we don't have to be as observant as people had to be then. They walked everywhere, so it was in their nature to really understand where they were going.
And they recognized each other's footsteps. Even in one case, when Eustacia walked by, someone knew who it was because of the swish that her silk dress made. Mm-hmm. It was pitch dark, and they knew that that was Eustacia.
Absolutely.
I just found that such a concept to really get your mind around. We're so accustomed to flashlights and floodlights and all of that. And here's a story that a lot of it takes place in the pitch dark.
Pitch dark, absolutely. I think that's part of the charm of the book. Well, I think one of the things that you're talking about is the heath was also a very contained place. It may have felt limitless to the characters who would find it nearly impossible to leave it, but it was also defined by specific geographic boundaries. So once you knew that terrain, and you've probably been there most of your life, it was in your blood, and you had nothing more to learn.
Yes, the characters who came and went from that area were anomalies, and commented on by the people who never left.
Yeah, they figured prominently in the plot.
Yes. I wanted to read just a short piece about the pace of life on the heath. To do things musingly and by small degrees seemed, indeed, to be a duty in the Egdon Valleys at this transitional hour, for there was that in the condition of the heath itself which resembled protracted and halting dubiousness. It was the quality of the repose appertaining to the scene. This was not the repose of actual stagnation, but the apparent repose of incredible slowness.
And on that landscape enters Eustacia Vye. And that is really, Return of the Native is her story.
Yes. I wondered why he called it Return of the Native, when it was obviously, to me at least, the story of Eustacia Vye.
There's something about the title that rings. It's an intriguing title.
It is.
And I wondered that too the first time I read it. It's like, well, who's the native here? And we find out later, and he plays an important role. And I think we could probably spend an hour or two talking about what that means. One of the things it means is here is Eustacia longing for a life outside of this heath on which she's stuck by circumstances of her late teen years. She has to go live with her grandfather. And this man is returning, and she hears about him, and everyone admires him. And what she's thinking is that she's getting someone cultivated, someone who brings a bit of that life that she remembered. And in fact, what she's getting is someone from the heath. And I think the title addresses that. And it tells us, I think, a lot in that. To me, it reveals what Eustacia's really getting rather than what she thinks she's getting.
Right. She's very much in fantasy land a great deal of the time. And Who wouldn't be? I mean, she's... well, we'll get to Eustacia in a minute, but I wanted to talk a little bit more about the slowness of which they were living. None of their clocks had the same time. It's mentioned that, you know, one person's clock was 10 after the hour, another was 10 till the hour. And the hourglass seemed to be a more reliable way of judging the time.
Well, I think that hourglass is a pretty interesting element, pretty intriguing symbol. And I think to understand the relationship to time and time as we think of it and time as Hardy wrote about it is they really were more tied to lightness and darkness, sunrise and sunset, and they lived their lives in that rhythm. And so at that point, whether it says 10 to 10 or 10 after 10, it doesn't really matter, you know, because they're going to start cutting furs, F-U-R-Z-E, when the sun, there's enough sunlight, and they're going to continue cutting until they can't see anymore. And so it was really the rhythm of that landscape again that determine time. The hourglass comes in to show, I think, Eustacia's sense that what she had and what she wanted were both very fleeting. And her longing for love, something that she believed was bestowed only on the youthful. And there she was, stuck in this very slow place and liked to see the sand going through her hourglass.
The first part of the book is called Three Women. The story opens with the bonfires on the 5th of November, the celebration.
And the Guy Fawkes celebration.
Guy Fawkes. And this beautiful, beautiful vision of the bonfires on the hillsides, something that seems, you know, very exotic to us today. But in the darkness, then they must have been just stunning. And the local people then, they function almost like a Greek chorus.
Exactly like, I think.
Okay.
I think you're dead on with that.
I must have recognized something there. And the extent to which they comment on the goings-on is very, very important to the way he's telling the story.
Absolutely. And it's also very lifelike. We're sitting around our fires. We're sitting around the dinner table. Or we're hanging out in a bar. We're with each other. What do? We talk about the people that we know, and we comment on them. We make judgments, good and bad. We relay information to each other. And so in that sense, that's really what Hardy is doing with the people from Egdon Heath, is he's telling the story and moving the plot forward in part with this Greek chorus of people who live there.
The dialogue I found charming.
Mm-hmm. Very lifelike and really requires the reader to slow down, to get into that rhythm, that slow rhythm of the pace of the heath, because there's no other way you can understand what they're saying, really.
And the first woman of the three women appears, well, actually doesn't appear. She's in a cart, which is going by, pulled by the Rattleman.
The Rattleman, yes.
And now he turns out to be very important in this story, and I think you get a hint of that in that he's one of the first to make an appearance. But within the cart is Thomason, also called Tamson for short, described as a quiet, ladylike little body.
Right, sweet little Tamson. And actually, another reading might say that she's the second of the three women to appear, but let's go with Tamson for now. She is all sweetness and pureness and goodness in the way that somebody who puts the boundaries of society and duty and appearance and Victorian appearance and propriety, she puts those things first. And Hardy conveys to us through his both descriptions of her and what she does, what unfolds with her, that is indeed what she is. She really represents that Victorian woman who could no more move outside the boundaries of society's laws than, you know, she could do backflips through the heath. She's the good girl, which is not to say insipid. She's the good girl.
And not nearly as interesting as Eustacia.
Not at all interesting.
Who is the next to be introduced. And what a dramatic introduction this is of Eustacia. We don't learn her name right away, but she's standing high on the hill.
She's standing high on the hill. She has a telescope. We find out fairly soon that she has an hourglass. We find out that she's petulant. She's making this little boy keep her fire going. Her fire is a big one, and it's being burned. This was important. In descriptions, she's using the really valuable hardwood to have a fire that endures, and it is. It's quite a while into the book before we learn her name. But as we've said already, Eustacia is what this book is about. And in this period of literature, she's one of the most vivid, compelling characters. To me, she's Hardy's best female character, the most engaging.
And she's unforgettable.
Can't forget her. No. And the description, when he finally does devote a chapter to describing her, Queen of Night.
It's gorgeous, isn't
it? You can
it?
Read it over and over, and that chapter is so rich and so full of love and a pending sense of doom. You know when you read this chapter that any character that is described in this way is not going to meet a happy ending in the way that Victorian literature defined happy endings. So there's a foreshadowing, and a word that is used even in descriptions of her. Shadow is a lot. Night, that chapter, Queen of Night. Black, she laughs at people who suggest she wear a color. She wears a velvet ribbon to hold her dark hair. And she laughs at people who suggest she wear a colored ribbon. She always wears black velvet. And I think right there you have a key of where this is going to end up.
Eustacia Vye was the raw material of a divinity. On Olympus, she would have done well with a little preparation. She had the passions and instincts which make a model goddess. That is, those which make not quite a model woman. She was in person full-limbed and somewhat heavy, without ruddiness as without pallor, and soft to the touch as a cloud. To see her hair was to fancy that a whole winter did not contain darkness enough to form its shadow. It closed over her forehead like nightfall extinguishing the western glow. Where did her dignity come from? Perhaps it was the gift of heaven, a happy convergence of natural laws. Among other things, opportunity had of late years been denied her of learning to be undignified, for she lived lonely. Isolation on a heath renders vulgarity well nigh impossible. It would have been as easy for the heath peonies, bats and snakes to be vulgar as for her. A narrow life in Budmouth might have completely demeaned her. The only way to look queenly, without realms or hearts to queen it over, is to look as if you had lost them, and Eustacia did that to a triumph. In the captain's cottage, she could suggest mansions she had never seen. Perhaps that was because she frequented a vaster mansion than any of them, the open hills. To be loved to madness, such was her great desire. Love was to her the one cordial which could drive away the eating loneliness of her days, and she seemed to long for the abstraction called passionate love more than for any particular lover.
You're listening to A Novel Idea. This is your host, Rosemary Manchester. My guest is Michelle Anna Jordan, and we're discussing Return of the Native by Thomas Hardy. She reminded me of one of the Pre-Raphaelites, in those lovely, voluptuous, gorgeous women. Of course, most of them had red hair, but occasionally they would paint someone with black hair.
It's an interesting connection, and I think you're absolutely right. And I'm just laughing because I have Drowning Ophelia on my wall and have since those days. Yeah, she very much, and again, you can see that as a foreshadowing. She's very much that sort of character, and it was the Pre-Raphaelites who came along just a little bit later, if I have my years correct.
Mm-hmm. You know she'll come to grief, but you know it's going to be a fascinating story about Eustasia. Mm-hmm. Now the third woman. There are a couple of possibilities for the third woman. There's Mrs. Yeobright, who's Thomason's aunt, who's a rather straight-laced, strong-minded woman. And then there's another woman who might be the third woman.
Yes, I think the easy call is that Mrs. Yeobright is the third woman. And she's certainly important to the plot. But more important to the plot, and actually the first woman to appear in the book, is Susan Nonsuch. And if you want to add or look at the layer of supernatural that Hardy sort of just, like he takes glitter and sprinkles it on his project, just a little tiny bit, it's Susan Nonsuch that conveys that to the novel. And when we see her, one of the men sweeps her up, and she's a very heavy woman, you see in the description, but one of the men sweeps her up and dances her around the coals. Very vivid point of description in the book. And so we're introduced to someone who's going to play a hugely important role when all of these women's lives converge.
Yes, and we later find out that she thinks Eustasia is a witch.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. And what she does because of that belief is very important to both the reader's impression of Eustasia, others' impression of Eustasia, and again, foreshadows Eustasia's fate.
Now, talk about that scene in church when Susan Nonsuch took out a needle and stuck it into Eustasia by his arm.
Right.
That had something to do with her belief that Eustasia was a witch. That was shocking.
It was shocking. Just as burning the Poppin?
Yes. Oh,
yeah,
yes.
Burning the Poppin, right, in the fire. A Poppin is sort of like a voodoo doll that is supposed to represent the person that you want to control. And Susan Nonsuch doing that is a very witch-like thing to do. And it was not Eustasia who was the witch. Eustasia was a woman out of time and out of place. She was in the wrong place. And that's where I think we see one of Hardy's themes really beginning to take shape and definition. Eustasia was rebellious, and she was rebelling against the Heath itself. And that's for a long time what it's about. And in rebelling against the Heath, it's not just against the landscape and the slowness and the lack of anything interesting to ever do. It's also against the small-mindedness of the people who live there. She's too big. She's too full of desire. She's too intense and passionate to ever fit into this placid landscape. And that's what Susan Nonsuch sees in Eustasia, yet she interprets it based on her own, you know, sort of partly superstitious, partly religious attitudes, and then tries to destroy what she sees, in part because it's too much of a threat. And if you want to look at this symbolically, you can start to see the clash of the Victorian and the modern, the growing urbanization and the old ways. That sort of thing. That's, I think, what those two women really represent. Superstition dying, but superstition also having the power to extinguish the more modern, the longing for something different.
And what you've just described is probably the situation in which most women were described as witches. They were simply rebellious, mm-hmm, and didn't fit into the pattern and refused to knuckle under to authority.
Yeah, they were not submissive.
Not submissive.
And a lot of bad things happened to a lot of real women.
Yes.
And Hardy, I think, was probably, I hate to say the best about anything, but Hardy was certainly one of the best to give a society that really wasn't ready for it a tender view of women who were more intense and passionate and rebellious, rather than a view that included a moral lesson not to be that way, I think that's one of the things that distinguished Hardy from some of the other ones. The really rebellious women, they're always punished, and we end up concluding that they deserve what they got. If you conclude that Eustacia deserves what she gets, you have no heart.
Right. I was impressed with how really little authority women had in their own lives. First we hear about Thomason's, she's in love with, his name is Damon.
Damon Wildy.
What a name. Now, you know he's up to no good.
You also know he's up to no good, and at the same time, you know, he's pretty irresistible.
He is irresistible.
He's one of those bad boys.
Yes.
And even the good girls and the bad girls all want him.
Yes. The custom of reading the banns in church, that was an interesting revelation into how women had so little to say in things. For the marriage to go ahead, the banns, B-A-N-N-S, are pronounced in church for several consecutive Sundays. But Thomason's aunt objects.
Yeah, anyone can object.
Oh, anyone can object.
I believe anyone connected can object. In communities at that time, if there was an objection to the banns, then the marriage was not going to go forward. And the plot progresses in part because Mrs. Yeobright, the widow Mrs. Yeobright, forbids the banns and won't let her daughter Tamsin marry Damon Wildeve because she thinks that he's bad news.
That's right. And so he and Eustacia have a little thing going between them while he's trying to make up his mind if he's going to marry Thomason.
Do you think it was a little thing? I don't know if I think it was a little thing. I kind of think it was a big thing.
I do, too. That was a euphemism. I was backing away from
a little in quotes.
Yes.
Yeah, and the reason that Mrs. Yeobright eventually allows the marriage to go forward is interesting, too, and again, I think looks forward. She decides to let her niece have the man she wants. That was not the norm. You know, you didn't necessarily marry for love or get to marry for love in those days. You looked for an advantageous marriage. You looked for a suitable marriage. You looked for a marriage that would benefit both families. Women who wanted to marry for love were trouble. And so even in this purity of a Thomasine, you see a little bit of that struggle towards what the modern world would eventually allow.
These women were very stubborn, these characters. They didn't have a lot of...
In Hardy, they always are.
Yes, regardless of they had little autonomy, but they were very stubborn. They could hold out for a long time.
And even the submissive ones were stubborn. They held their convictions and held to their convictions. There weren't really any wishy-washy characters. I don't believe he created any. None I can think of.
I spoke to Rosemary Morgan of the Hardy Association. She had some insights as well about Eustacia.
I don't know what your reading is on Eustacia and critical readings, but I haven't come across anybody who has dealt with her psychological condition of depression, which Hardy details at length. He actually calls it something else. I think he calls it hypochondriasis or something. But the detailing of her chronic condition, her depression of spirits, she finds relief in walking, she paces on the heath, and all the stuff which is what was the best thing for depressives to do, her languid moods, her mood swings, her eating loneliness. And this is a classic characterization of chronic depression, but not a single critic will address this. They want her to be something else. They want her to be a romantic figure. And a beautiful woman doesn't do this depressive stuff. Beautiful women don't do that.
That's just fascinating that they won't accept that characterization.
I haven't come across it anywhere, and yet I'm very interested in that aspect of Return of the Natives, that Hardy details this for us. And of course this woman is dreaming of some man to come in so she can, you know, of course she is. She's desperately lonely. She's desperately bored. Wildeve isn't exactly, you know, and how do you turn around to a man and say, well, you're not the hottest thing, you know, I would really actually rather have something a little more exciting. You can't really say that to a guy, but that's all she has. Her choices are very limited.
Yes, and she really can't get out of there by herself.
Not at all. no money, no social contacts. They isolate her. She lives with her grandfather. She has no social life. You know, it's a prison.
It is. It is. No, I thought she did the thing that she needed to do to get out of there. I thought she was extremely courageous.
I'm glad. I'm so glad to hear that. Sounds like you've got a grasp of Eustacia. I'm so glad to hear it.
You know, I do love to read, and I love the characters. And, of course, Eustacia is irresistible. We're going to take a short break now. You're listening to A Novel Idea. This is your host, Rosemary Manchester. My guest is Michelle Anna Jordan. And we're talking about Thomas Hardy's novel, The Return of the Native. We'll be right back. You're listening to A Novel Idea. This is your host, Rosemary Manchester. We're discussing Thomas Hardy's novel, Return of the Native. My guest is Michelle Anna Jordan. So now we have our cast of characters assembled, except for the native who's about to return. And his name is Clem, short for Clement. And it's interesting the way Hardy sets it up, because everyone is talking about him before he makes his appearance. That's always such an interesting way to introduce your character. Any number of people comment on what they think of Clement. And he's been in Paris managing a firm for a diamond merchant.
Mm-hmm.
That's certainly exotic.
Seems very worldly, doesn't he?
He left the family farm and went off to Paris. And now he's coming back. So obviously everyone is talking about that. Now, the way that Eustacia sets it up, the opportunity to meet him, I found it fascinating.
It's a great scene.
Isn't it a great scene? Do you want to?
You can go ahead.
The mummers.
Mummers, yes.
At Christmas time, is that right?
Yeah, and they perform in costume. And if memory serves me correctly, Eustacia bribes one of the mummers to let her go put on his costume. And the bribe is pretty interesting in itself. But she goes and she performs, as mummers do, and is able to see Clem through her mask. And of course, you know, this is Eustacia's only hope. Damon is not available. There's nobody whom she's interested in, except for all this whispering about the native coming back from Paris, and this is going to be her salvation.
Yes, and really, it's almost love at first sight with her when she sees him.
Desire at first sight.
Very good, very good. And the passage about him sitting there in the dark with just his face illumined, Hardy says it's Rembrandt-like. Mm-hmm. And makes quite a point of Clement's face. And that probably was what Eustacia was seeing at the time. And she was so attracted by his face. It makes you wonder just exactly what it was in his face. But Hardy is so good at setting up the scene that you're with Eustacia at this point looking at him.
Mm-hmm.
And she falls in love. Or in love?
Does she fall in love? You know, that's a question that is difficult after a dozen readings. It's a difficult question for me to answer. On one level, we always have to come back to the fact, well, she felt whatever Hardy wanted her to feel because she doesn't actually exist. She's a character. So what is Hardy doing with creating, you know, this connection between the two of them? What is he trying to show? And I think one of the things he's trying to show is Eustacia's desperation.
Yes.
It was inevitable that upon her first glimpse of him, she was going to think herself in love. One of the lines in the description of her in that Queen of Night chapter is, you know, her, can't quote it exactly, was like her one desire was to be loved to madness. You know, this was a woman who was desperate to feel passionate romantic love, and there were no options for her on the Heath. Now, was Hardy saying about passionate love in that when he shows us the side of Eustacia? What's he saying about the lack of it on the Heath, the abundance of it apparently in the cities? I think that arena is where I go when I think about the relationship between Eustacia and Klim. I never believed for a minute that it was true love. I think, oh, wait, no, they didn't exist anyway.
But when you do see her situation, she really can't stay where she is. She can't really leave by herself.
No, that was not an option, and she didn't have enough money anyway. But there was no, it would not have been, it would have broken all propriety for her to go back to Budmouth, where she was born and raised. Her parents died, which is the reason she ended up on the Heath. She had no other relatives that were aware of. She had no options, as women at that point had no options. You couldn't pack up and move to New York if you didn't like living in Sonoma County. I can do that. You can do that. Any of us can do that today. But you couldn't then. It was an impossibility. And you would have been, if you could even figure out the physical logistics and the geographic logistics, you would be totally shunned by society. So Eustacia is stuck on the Heath. And I think part of what Hardy is doing is exploring that really appalling condition and lack of options for women. In one sense, even though it's a lush, possibly overwritten to some degree, beautiful mid-Victorian novel, it's also, in a sense, a feminist treatise almost on the condition of women at the time.
And do you think it still has relevance today, particularly with respect to the condition of women, although it's true that we can pack up and move to New York if we have the wherewithal?
I think what has the most relevance today is Hardy's use of the landscape as a character. And I've used this book time and again to refer to the region of Sonoma County known as Lakeville, which to me, for several reasons, is parallel to the Heath. It's very much what I imagine the Heath looking like. Lakeville with that low grass that rattles in the summer and the late fall winds. It's not a rainforest, you know. Redwood trees don't grow there. There are no oak trees. It's dairy country. There's undulating hills and a river that runs through it. And some of the descriptions of of nightfall and the way night comes to the heath really match.
The heath wore the appearance of an installment of night which had taken up its place before its astronomical hour was come. Darkness to a great extent arrived hereon, while day stood distinct in the world. Looking upwards, a first cutter would have been inclined to continue work. Looking down, he would have decided to finish his faggot and go home. The distant rims of the world and of the firmament seemed to be a division in time, no less than a division in matter. At this transitional point of its nightly roll into darkness, the great and particular glory of the Egdon Waste began, and nobody could be said to understand the heath who had not been there at such a time. The sombre stretch of rounds and hollows seemed to rise and meet the evening gloom in pure sympathy, the heath exhaling darkness as rapidly as the heavens precipitated it. The place became full of a watchful intentness now, for when other things sank brooding to sleep, the heath appeared slowly to awake and listen.
You can imagine if you scratch under the surface of Sonoma County's history, get back to about 1850, 1860, 1870, you realize that Lakeville was as isolated as Egdon Heath. And when people came north from, say, San Francisco, they came up the Petaluma River, and there at Gilardi, what was Gilardi's and is now Papa's Taverna, that's Lakeville Marina. And that's where people who first entered Sonoma County came, because the riverboat captains would not drive any further. And so they disembarked, and they were taken in a stagecoach to Petaluma or Santa Rosa on narrow, rickety roads. Their luggage couldn't go along with them. It was put on an ox cart. And so at that point, if you're there in Lakeville in the dairy country, which is about anywhere from 6 to 10 miles, I think it's about a 4-5 mile long if you're driving through it, looking to Petaluma or looking to San Francisco was like thinking of Budmouth. So I see a lot of similarities, and the disappearance of that and what we're losing when we lose an area like Lakeville, which just made a narrow escape and not becoming the site of a casino and 5-star hotel. And I was one of the people who helped fight to save it. Part of what we're losing is that old, isolated, wild landscape that can speak to you in the way that the landscape speaks to the characters of Egdon Heath. Does that make sense?
It makes a great deal of sense, but I can't help but wonder of the Eustacia Vyse who might have been trapped in Lakeville.
Absolutely.
And if they were able to get on with their lives in some way, or if they were as tragic as Eustacia.
We don't know. I've read through some of the early archives of Lakeville, and the people I met today who lived in Lakeville when it was still somewhat isolated, of course, they wouldn't be the Eustacias, would they, because they made it all these years. I've heard wonderful stories of courtships in Lakeville, but that was a little bit later. What you'd really have to do is get in, I think it's the Petaluma Library, where there are some old letters and old journals from Lakeville, and see if you could find someone. Certainly there are... We always have cycles of flood and drought, and the landscape and the weather can certainly, you know, hit you hard. And so I wouldn't be surprised, you know, if in someone's diary we could learn a really intriguing story of someone who longed to escape.
Yes, I grew up in a small town in Kansas, and I feel some of the frustration of the, you know, the small town life. It's all the gossiping and the, mm-hmm. the way in which they, everything that you did was known and discussed mm-hmm. and commented on. And to me, that's one of the elements of small town life that I found difficult.
Yeah, it's oppressive. And that's very much operative in The Return of the Native.
Oh, yes.
What people think, what they say, how they judge you. And we look at that today. That's much more common in small towns and suburbia. In New York, who cares? Everyone's too busy, you know, and there's certainly that element of who's dating whom, but not that petty picking apart of others' lives. And I think that's partly a function of there's not so much to do. And there was less to do in the days when Return of the Native was written, because remember, that there weren't electric lights yet. You know, life was lived more in rhythm with the rotation of the sun and the seasons. So we have a false ability to have busier lives than they had then.
I'd like to hear a little bit about Tess of the D'Urbervilles and Sue Bridehead and Arabella, later heroines of Hardy. We've talked to Eustacia over quite a bit. What about his later leading women characters?
Well, I think you see Eustacia, or the qualities in Eustacia, tempered in a certain way, refined as far as the role, the symbolic role he wants these women to play, or maybe more accurately, what he wants to express through them about women. And in Tess, you can almost see Tess as a mixture of Thomason and Eustacia. And she is motivated by duty and basically sold down the river by her family. It's very interesting. If anyone has seen the movie Tess of the D'Urbervilles, and I so want to talk to Roman Polanski about this because he made a really big mistake. And I think that I blame the editor. I can't believe that Polanski made this mistake. But at one point you see Tess taking milk to market with the family horse, and the milk's in the back of the cart, and that's how that family makes their living. They sell milk, and her brother's with her, and she falls asleep at the cart. And in the film version, then you jump to the next scene. Everything in Tess of the D'Urbervilles, everything hinges on the fact that when she falls asleep, the horse goes out of control and is pierced through the heart and dies. The novel does not make any sense whatsoever because there's the family. They have no way to earn a living, and they look up a man that they think might be related in some way, and they send Tess to this man. And Tess, I believe, Hardy sends Tess and gets her to agree to go because of her guilt at feeling that she feels so responsible that she has to make amends by going and seeing if there's any way that this possible distant cousin who is apparently wealthy will help the family. And that's how the plot unfolds. And she becomes his mistress for a while because she has no other choice. She submits to her fate out of guilt. And we see a lot of that, submitting to your fate out of guilt. And there's a character very similar to Klim, who it's Angel Claire, who comes along and loves the innocent Tess, but reviles the guilty Tess. And don't want to reveal too much about the plot. I did that once in front of my daughters, and I will never do it again. But in that book, Hardy expresses, I think, one of the qualities that he really became known for, if you read through the criticism that's all over the place, and that's chance and circumstance. Before Angel and Tess are married, she writes a full confession of her time with D'Urberville. She writes it in a letter and goes and slips it under Angel Claire's door. It goes under the rug rather than over the rug. And so when he marries her, she thinks everything's okay, that he's forgiven her and that there's nothing to talk about. And eventually she discovers that he doesn't know anything. And it's a harrowing book from that point on, just harrowing. And she does not come to a good end. And then in progressing to Jude the Obscure, which is where I think the form completely breaks down, and by form, I mean the form of the Victorian novel. You have Sue Bridehead, who is all cerebral, you know, very mental, very abstracted. And then you have the lusty, earthy, pig's bladder in, you know, his face, Arabella. So again, you see in Tess, you see the two characters converging and becoming one. And then in Jude the Obscure, you see them separating again. And Sue is the modern woman and wants to live a modern life and does in many ways and is violently and wretchedly punished for it. And then you see Arabella, who gets Jude for a while, but is so simple and dull that she absolutely cannot engage with the very also cerebral, mental Jude. And Jude is one of the most devastating books you can read. And at this time, novels such as Hardy's, he was an extremely, extremely popular author. His novels came out monthly as chapters. And his reading public turned on him. They weren't happy with Tess. Tess caused him some problems because of the ending. But by the time we get to Jude the Obscure, they were furious. And he said a man would have to be a fool to stand up to get shot. And he never wrote another novel. He turned to poetry and wrote beautiful poetry and very successfully for another 20, 25 years until he died. But that point, Jude the Obscure, that's when, to me, the Victorian novel ended. And it ended because the concerns that became legitimate to art and literature could no longer be contained in the form of the Victorian novel.
You said something earlier that really intrigued me, and I wanted to hear more about it, and that was the concept of decadence.
Well, you know, parallel to, you brought up the Pre-Raphaelites, which were the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood, a group of artists, poets, produce some wonderful work and just breathtaking art. That's one of my favorite periods in art. And then, oh, there were writers like Ronald Furbank. There was J.K. Weissman, who wrote in English, it's Against the Grain, Au Rebours in France, which was the epitome of the decadent expression. And I got very interested in what I thought was the connection between decadence and that period, which was the end of the 19th century, became known as the decadence. And what most people, looking at it superficially, think of is, you know, the painters, Oscar Wilde, you know, with a big calla lily in his green velvet jacket, and sort of the wild, artistic, expressive side. And that's not really the pure meaning of decadence. What decadence really means, and you sort of see this emerging at the end of centuries. We saw a revival a few years ago as we approached this new millennium. What the word means and what the concept means is a decline from the prior state, from a prior state of excellence. And while Oscar Wilde, whom I adored and studied a great deal, another very tragic yet marvelously talented figure, he sort of expressed that artful, playful flaunting of authority and indulging the senses which people associate with decadence. But what I think Jude the Obscure and Thomas Hardy did was reveal its true meaning, which is the decline from the prior state. You see the decline of the Victorian novel expressed most beautifully in Jude. I mean, in here we're sort of using Hardy as a sacrificial lamb, you know. He's on the altar, and I'm stabbing him through the heart in a way by saying this. But I really believe that that's what it is, and there are some critics that bear that out as well, who've looked into Hardy much deeper than I've been able to. I did not make a career of it. But I don't see it as an overall artistic failure. I see it as sort of a tragic time to live, and that as an artist, he ushered in the modern era, and it had to be done, and he did it brilliantly. And if he had to fail in a certain way to do that, that's okay.
Oh, this has been wonderful, Michelle, to spend the time with you talking about Thomas Hardy.
And well, it's a great opportunity to revisit, you know, a subject I really love, and in particular, a novel I really love. We make it sound like it might be difficult to wade through it, but it's really if you get a chance to slow down, it's a wonderful read. And if you need a good cry, it's also a perfect way to get one.
Yes, and I think you've certainly piqued the attention of our listeners who may remember Hardy from something they had to read in high school.
I know, it's ridiculous to have people read these books in high school. It just makes no sense. You'll just bore them to death. They care only about the plot, and they won't get any of the subtleties. And, you know, the high school student who could read this book in depth, I don't think I want to know them. It would be really scary.
It would be scary. Yeah, it's a book for adults, folks.
Absolutely.
Yes. My guest this evening has been Michelle Anna Jordan, customarily heard on KRCB on Sunday evenings at 7 on her own show, Mouthful. Michelle, it's been a treat to share your knowledge of great literature, especially the work of Thomas Hardy. Thomas Hardy's books are available at your local library, and I bought a copy of Return to the Native at a local independent bookstore in the Dover Thrift Edition for $3.50. What a bargain! Now I can splurge on a bottle of good wine. Thanks to Suzanne Lang, producer, and Katie Stolman, post-production, for their work on the show. Thanks to Rosemarie Morgan of the Hardy Association for her contribution, and Mac McCaffrey, who read selections from Return of the Native.
And now it's time for novel writing, which today comes from the West Country, from Dorset.
Hello and welcome to Dorchester, where a very good crowd has turned out to watch local boy Thomas Hardy write his new novel, The Return of the Native, on this very pleasant July morning. This will be his 11th novel and the 5th of the very popular Wessex novels, and here he comes! Here comes Hardy, walking out toward his desk. He looks confident, he looks relaxed, very much the man in form, as he acknowledges this very good-natured bank holiday crowd. And the crowd goes quiet now as Hardy settles himself down at the desk, body straight, shoulders relaxed, pen held lightly but firmly in the right hand. He dips the pen in the ink, and he's off! It's the first word, but it's not a word! Oh, no, it's a doodle way up on the top of the left-hand margin. It's a piece of meaningless scribble, and he signed his name underneath it. Oh, dear, what a disappointing start. But he's off again, and here he goes, the first word off Thomas Hardy's new novel at 10:35 on this very lovely morning. It's three letters, it's the definite article, and it's the Dennis.
Well, this is true to form. No surprises there. He started 5 of his 11 novels to date with a definite article. We've had 2 of them with it. There's been 1 but, 2 ats, 1 on, and a Dolores. Though that, of course, was never published.
I'm sorry to interrupt you there, Dennis, but he's crossed it out. Thomas Hardy here on the first day of his new novel has crossed out the only word he's written so far, and he's gazing off into space. Oh, dear, he's signed his name again.
It looks like Tessa de d'Urbervilles all over again.
But he's down again and writing, Dennis. He's written the again. He's crossed it out again, and he's written A. And there's a second word coming up straight away, and it's Sat. A-Sat, doesn't make sense. A-Saturday. It's a Saturday, and the crowd are loving it. They're really enjoying this novel. And it's afternoon. A Saturday afternoon is a confident beginning. And he's straight on to the next word. It's in. A Saturday afternoon. In. No. November. November spelled wrong. He's left out the second E. But he's not going back. It looks as though he's going for the sentence. And it's the first verb coming up. It's the first verb of the novel. And it's was. And the crowd are going wild. A Saturday afternoon in November was. And a long word here. A pro. Is it approval? No, it's approaching. Approaching. A Saturday afternoon in November was approaching. And he's done the definite article, the again. And he's writing fluently, easily, with flowing strokes of the pen as he comes up to the middle of this first sentence. And with this 11th novel well underway and the prospects of a good day's writing ahead, back to the studio.
This is Rosemarie Manchester, your host for A Novel Idea, reminding you that there's no such thing as too many books.